little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little.
Well, this is Bob Frelick, along here with
Julia Minton.
And we're very excited tonight. Well, welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And I want to mention, though, that that snippet of music that you heard was a song by George Harab. He's a musician, a podcaster, all-around interesting, a talented guy. Think for Yourself is the name of that tune.
Quite apropos.
Yeah. Well, I want to remind you that you can contact us on Facebook by going to the Facebook page, typing in Thinking Clearly Radio, and we pop up. At least our Facebook page pops up.
Thinking Clearly Radio.
Usually I talk about our working definition of critical thinking and just review that for folks, but I'm not going to do that because I want to get to our guest as soon as I can. Our topic tonight is going to range from the importance of critical thinking in general to discussion of the importance of developing practices in healthcare and other professions, as well as policy in the political arena, which is strongly guided by good evidence and scientific research. And I'm excited to introduce our guest. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Novella, a clinical neurologist and assistant professor at Yale University School of Medicine. He's also the executive editor of the blogs Science-Based Medicine.
But I'm familiar with him because I listen to Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, a very familiar voice for us. And he also has blogs at the site called Neurologica. He's a master teacher of two courses in the Great Courses series. The first is Your Deceptive Mind, a Scientific Guide to Critical Thinking Skills. And what's the second one? Do you know?
Medical Myths, Lies, and Half-Truths. What we think we know may be hurting us. And it couldn't be more relevant these days.
So as we used to say in the 60s and 70s, we're stoked.
Oh, so stoked.
To have as a guest, Dr. Stephen Novella. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you. Well, let's get right into it. There's lots of folks in this area that are excited to hear that very familiar voice. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and I want to acknowledge your contributions that you've made through the Great Courses offering, and we mentioned that, Your Deceptive Mind, A Scientific Guide to Critical Thinking Skills. I own that, and I just reviewed again the last two lectures in that series. It's a wonderful series. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in the production of that Great Courses.
Well, I mean, they contacted me to see if I would be interested in producing some courses with them. And they have a pretty thorough vetting process. So we do like a test lecture. My test lecture was on the 10% of the brain myth. Then they market test that. And eventually they said, yeah, you're testing well, so we'd like you to do a course with us. Actually, the first one I did was the medical myths one, which was doing well. And then they, like a year later, they said, what would you like to do as your second course? And that's, I basically just said, yeah, I want to do critical thinking in the brain, you know, something like that. And that, Your Deceptive Mind evolved out of that.
That's great. So you're also the host and producer of the podcast, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, along with Kara Santa Maria, Evan Bernstein. Thank you. And your brothers, Bob and Jay.
That's right.
Can you kind of compare and contrast the term skeptic or skepticism with critical thinking, what the relationship is there?
Yeah, I mean, critical thinking is part of skepticism, but skepticism is more than that. So when we use the term skepticism, we're referring to scientific skepticism, not just doubt for doubt's sake, certainly not like global warming skepticism type of thing, which is really denial. And not even philosophical skepticism, which is more the denial that we could know anything. We think you could know stuff. It's about promoting science, logic, reason, critical thinking, understanding how our brains work, understanding how we know anything, the nature of knowledge itself, and then just, you know, rigorously applying that to any empirical questions about the universe. You know, essentially, we want to know what's really, really real, you know, not just what we want to be real, not what just seems to be real, but how can we actually, as reliably as possible, have some knowledge about the universe. And we combine that with some consumer protection, promoting science education, and we try to build an expertise where we think it's needed. So we fancy ourselves experts in pseudoscience and fraud, which is, I think, something that's largely missing from academia. And that manifests in a lot of interesting ways. So even, you know, good scholars, good scientists who know their field can get blindsided by pseudoscience because they don't know how pseudoscience works. They think that understanding the science is enough, but it really isn't. So that's kind of also where we fill in the gaps.
Could you just maybe give us a quick example of what you mean by pseudoscience and why that's an appropriate description?
So pseudoscience, we talk about the demarcation problem. Like, there isn't this clean separation between like perfect science on one side and pure pseudoscience on the other. It's a continuum. We like to keep science as rigorous as possible. But if the methods of science and the integrity of science breaks down enough, it ceases to really be functional. So the term pathological science is sometimes used. It's basically, it ceases to actually be a functioning science. One of the key features of that would be that it essentially works backwards. There's, for whatever reason, there's a desired conclusion, whether it's ideological or just some, you know, something fantastical that somebody wants to believe, or just, you know, a crank scientist who gets, you know, lost in his own musings and doesn't really connect it to reality anymore. But then the process becomes subverted to proving the conclusion rather than in finding out if it's true or what is true. And so, you know, basically science gets turned on its head. And that is what we call pseudoscience. And there's obviously, you know, countless examples of that.
Dr. Novella, would I be accurate if I started singing Happy Birthday
to me?
To Skeptic's Guide to the Universe? Because yes, my information would. Said yeah. It's your first podcast was May 2005, May 4th.
Yep, that's correct. 12 years.
All right.
Congratulations.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. It's also Star Wars Day, so may the 4th be with you.
All right, thank you. Well, part of the underlying the question that I think these first couple questions is that you're a doctor, a medical doctor. How did you get interested in the whole idea of skepticism, critical thinking, pseudoscience, all that? What is it? Because there's a lot of folks that are not doing the kinds of things that you are doing. What is it that motivated you and got you on this path?
Well, that predates my medical education. I mean, I was always a science enthusiast since I can remember. You know, my brothers and I, since we were very young, ate up every cool science, you know. And at the same time, we were into science fiction as well. But as young kids, we couldn't really distinguish between good science and pseudoscience. And unfortunately, a lot of what passed for science in the mainstream media was pseudoscience. Like, for example, we loved the show In Search Of, because it was an exploration of all these cool things. Like, oh, did aliens build the pyramids? You know, et cetera. And of course, it was hosted by Leonard Nimoy, so that's all the better. But as we, you know, as I got older, as I started to like study science formally, began to realize that, wait a minute, this all can't be true. I mean, there's some legitimate scientists over here saying that this other stuff that I thought was science is not. That it's bullcrap. So how do we know? You know, what's the difference here? What's going on? I also just, you know, because I live in the world, started to encounter ideologies like creationism that were, you know, diametrically opposed to things that I knew to be valid sciences like evolution. And so that I was fascinated with that. You know, just the notion that somebody could believe something that was so demonstrably wrong was endlessly fascinating to me. What is going on in the mind of somebody who could, you know, construct this belief system out of complete lies and illogic. So I guess at that point, you know, I was a skeptic in a lot of ways. And then just, you know, as my education continued and I went to medical school, obviously there's a ton of pseudoscience in medicine. The two things obviously mesh very well. And then, you know, eventually I encountered, you know, organized skepticism and, you know, basically a bunch of people who had shared the same fascination and frustration, you know, that I did. And that was kind of an obvious connection.
Well, one of the main topics that we'd like to talk about, and this topic actually was prompted by, I don't know if you remember last year, that Neil deGrasse Tyson, he had a tweet where he talked about that we ought to have a country called Rationalia, and with a one-line constitution that says all policy will be advanced by science or supported by science. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And he got a lot of blowback. I mean, there were many, many articles that were written thinking that he was very naive and everything. I didn't take him literally. I think I knew what he was trying to say by that. But that really prompted and got us thinking about this topic. And in general, it's described both as evidence-based and science-based practices and policies. So I've heard both of those terms. I know I've heard you talk about the difference between those, but could you kind of describe the difference between those two, evidence-based and science-based, when we're talking about practices and policies?
So I know exactly what those terms mean when we refer to medicine, because there's an evidence-based medicine movement that defines exactly what it means. And I coined the phrase science-based medicine, so I know exactly what I meant by that. So I could tell you what I mean by that in the context of medicine. I don't know how people are using those terms outside of medicine. There isn't any, I think, standard definition. But for me, this is the critical difference. So evidence-based medicine, which is fine, it's good as far as it goes, but it just has some flaws in how it approaches the relationship between scientific evidence and the application of that evidence, or the practice of medicine in this case. So the point of evidence-based medicine was to say that we when something makes sense, it still may be wrong. We don't know enough to be able to say that a treatment will work just because it makes sense to our current understanding. We actually have to do clinical studies and find out if it works. And we should really only be basing our practice on things that have been proven, not just things that are supported by tradition or common sense or personal experience or whatever. So again, that's all fine. I agree with that. But what they inadvertently did when they said, we need to base it on clinical practice, was that they then stopped considering or failed to consider the plausibility. Does this actually make sense? And you could be forgiven for that in the 1980s, because at that time within mainstream medicine, just the very notion that somebody would use a treatment that made no sense or that was, contradicted by basic science wasn't even on the radar. It wasn't even a thing. You know, they used to call that fraud at that time. You know, there wasn't any alternative, complementary, integrative, whatever. So they just didn't consider it. So it's partly just an unfortunate coincidence, and maybe it's not a coincidence, that the alternative medicine movement, basically rebranding health fraud as alternative, was taking off at the same time. And they were like, yeah, this is great. Evidence-based medicine is wonderful. We don't have to consider plausibility, which they loved because they have zero plausibility or sometimes very low plausibility. And the EBM movement just was not prepared for it. In my opinion, in looking back, they got blindsided by this. But it was interesting because it exposed some very interesting flaws in the way they conceptualize evidence. And we now know, and there's been a lot of literature on this, I won't go into all the nitty-gritty details, but there have been lots of researchers looking at the medical literature, that scientific studies. And to try to crystallize this a little bit, we know that most published studies are wrong because they're false positive, which makes sense because most new guesses or hypotheses in medicine and in science in general are going to turn out to be wrong. So you have to you know, the medical science has to mature to a certain point before we could say if something is probably true or not, before we could say if a treatment probably is safe and effective. But and what that point is, you don't know unless you also consider the scientific plausibility of the treatment. You have to consider both together just mathematically when you're evaluating the data. And so the EBM fails because it assumed that everything was plausible. And now we're in a world clearly where everything is not equally plausible. And you have to factor that back in. So that's why we call what we promote science-based medicine. It's not just based upon this one type of clinical evidence. You're looking at all of the scientific evidence, from basic science to other sciences to synergy among science and the clinical science, and then making your decisions based upon that more thorough analysis. And we know now that you have to do that. Otherwise, you really don't know how to interpret the clinical data.
So what you're talking about is there may be a study that shows that some treatment or procedure is effective or passes muster in terms of the way the study that particular study was constructed, but it violates laws of physics or principles of chemistry. And what you're saying is that was not taken into consideration and should be. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, we're mostly talking here about the gray zone, right? Obviously, if there's a treatment that is reproducibly effective with the most rigorous studies, could be replicated over and over again, you know, meets the highest clinical standards, is a clear effect size, you know, all, checks all the boxes. Yeah, that's something that we could clearly say works, even if we don't understand the mechanism. But most things are not in that category, right? Most things are like, oh, there's pretty good evidence, or there's some evidence, or it's ambiguous. You know, the effect sizes are small, or there's the decline effect, where the more we study it, the smaller the effect size gets, and we haven't sure if it's bottomed out yet or not. So when you're and so most of the time we're practicing in this gray zone where we have imperfect evidence, and in that realm you really really have to know about prior plausibility. And in order to be able to make sense of that data. So if we have a little bit of positive evidence for something, but it breaks the laws of physics, I guarantee you that's just flawed clinical trials, or that's just publication bias or researcher bias. That's a much more likely explanation for that than we have to rewrite the physics textbooks because of a placebo effect, essentially. But if you have a treatment that, you know, according to everything we know, it absolutely should work, or it's just a very minimal incremental extension of our knowledge to say that this works, and you have really, you know, good data, maybe not ironclad definitive data, but you know, one notch below that. Okay, sure, that's a reasonable treatment to use because it's plausible and it makes sense. And again, this has been proven rigorously mathematically by people, you know, statisticians looking at the literature showing that you really can only make sense of the data when you know what the prior plausibility is.
An approach known as the Bayesian approach?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we advocate the Bayesian approach. This is where it gets really wonky, though, you know, for statisticians. If you rely too heavily on p-values, which is one way to looking at data, that massively favors false positives as well. You know, you tend to reject the null hypothesis prematurely. But if you take a Bayesian approach, you realize that even data that might have an impressive p-value moves the needle very little, meaning after the study, it's only slightly more likely that this thing is true or not true than it was before. But people tend to oversimplistically look at a study, say, oh, it's statistically significant, therefore the hypothesis is true. And that's just not true. That's wrong. It's statistically naive. So we're trying to change the culture of medicine in a way that statisticians want to change it. We didn't come up with this idea. We're just saying, hey, the statisticians are saying that you're doing it wrong. And, you know, we really need to do it properly. And in order to do it that way. We need to consider prior plausibility and a Bayesian approach and these other effect sizes and all these other things. And if when you do that, guess what? The things that make sense are the things that tend to work. And all this stuff which doesn't make sense and would break the laws of physics, it doesn't meet the muster. It doesn't meet statistical analysis when you do it properly. And that makes sense. So we just think that, you know, we should do what the experts are telling us we should do.
That's fascinating. I'm glued. It's a very nuanced. I've been hearing the integration of evidence-based practices in a more policy that's being written, and that really makes me kind of optimistic. But I'm hearing now these nuances that I'd never really considered before, and I appreciate you explaining them really well. And I assume, you know, this is kind of what led you to founding your blog, Science-Based Medicine. Could you tell us a little bit about what that blog's about, what you hope to achieve, you know, why, what motivated you to start it and keep it going?
Yeah, well, the idea came, it's been about 10 years now. So some colleagues of mine and I were publishing a journal called the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine. And this was a print, you know, journal that we were publishing. And trying to get it into accepted as a peer-reviewed journal, and we were running into trouble because they kept sending it to quote-unquote experts to review it to see if we were, you know, above the bar in terms of being peer-reviewed. But of course, the experts were alternative medicine proponents, and they were like, "No, these guys are all trashing alternative medicine," so we couldn't break through. And we realized that the only people who are interested in this journal are either proponents who don't like what we have to say or our fellow skeptics. And together, that's like 5% of everybody. And 95% of, you know, physicians and scientists didn't care because they didn't care one way or the other. So we just weren't getting anywhere with that. So I said, OK, we need to take a different approach. So I'm just going to start a blog. I'm going to focus it more about what we're for, you know, not what we're against. You know, I came up with the name Science-Based Medicine. That's what we're promoting, right? We're going to promote something positive. And, you know, we're not going to try to get peer-reviewed. We're just going to just write to a broad audience, you know, professional and public, try to get things out quickly and get into the news cycle and just try to influence, you know, the culture and education and the profession that way and see what happens. So I think it's worked out really well, though we're kind of getting to the point now where we're like, hey, this is working out well, but what's next? You know, now how do we keep pushing this ball forward? To be honest, we're not really sure. You know, we're having talks about what we can do, but it's not really clear, you know, because there's so many moving parts here, and we have no resources, you know, because it really is just, you know, worldwide, maybe 50 or 100 people who care about this sort of thing. And we're kind of already doing everything that we can. But I think it has been, it has succeeded in what I wanted it to do. But we know that it was never meant to be the be all end all of, you know, promoting science and medicine. There's a lot of other things that we need to do as well.
Seems like it was a good, it is a good contribution to the larger dialogue that's taking place. So if folks want to check that out and learn a little bit about it, it's a sciencebasedmedicine.org.
And what's interesting is that it seems to me that you're learning as you go and finding a way and sort of a cutting edge, because that is the larger issues, is how we begin to introduce evidence-based or science-based, not just in medicine, but also other practices, professional practices, and in government policy. But I do want to remind our listeners that we are talking to Dr. Stephen Novella, and we'll get into another issue in just a moment, but he's a neurologist and assistant professor at Yale University School of Medicine, among other things, as we've talked about. Well, on this show, we've had a couple of guests who have emphasized how important it is for critical thinkers to go to original sources of information, so that learning something about good research design seems to be very important. Can you take a few minutes to review the so-called gold standard design, the randomized controlled blind study or trial, and include in that a discussion of statistical significance. You mentioned the p-value, but I'm not sure our listeners know what that is. So if you could explain.
Nobody knows what that is. I ask almost every medical student that I teach and resident to give me the technical definition of a p-value, and so far 0% of people have been able to do that. I think only statisticians and people interested in it, directly can tell you what the technical definition is. But let me back up for a minute. So, gold standard, but you're talking about clinical trials. So again, I would remind you that this is just one type of information we bring to bear when we're asking questions about, treatments and interventions, any kind of medical interventions. This is what we call an efficacy trial. And what we're trying to determine with those kind of trials is whether or not there's a physiological effect from the one specific variable that we're trying to isolate, whether it's a drug or a procedure or any intervention, a nutritional intervention, a vitamin supplement, whatever. We want to know what happens when we adjust this one variable. That's an efficacy trial. And the gold standard there is the double-blind placebo-controlled trial. So it's double-blind so that the patients and whoever's assessing the outcome don't know who's getting the treatment and who is getting a sham treatment, or what we call a placebo. You also have to make sure that you're isolating the variable of interest, that you're following it for a long enough period of time, that you are studying an appropriate population, that it's properly blinded, that the dropout rate isn't too high. There's a lot of things that can go wrong, with a clinical trial like that. That your dosing is appropriate, that your markers, what are you choosing to follow? It's not always obvious. You might think that it's an obvious thing, that people are getting better. But how do you define better? Do they feel better? Is there some parameter that's getting better? Are they living longer? Is their quality of life better? There's a whole bunch of different variables that you could measure to try to answer that question, and that can often dramatically affect the outcome. And then finally, what you'd like to see is that there's a consensus of multiple independently replicated studies that are showing consistently that there is not just a statistically significant effect, but a clinically significant effect, and not just clinically significant, but one that has a good separation of signal to noise, which depends on, again, what outcome measure you're looking at. So if you're studying pain, there's a lot of noise in that system, meaning people's pain is tremendously variable and subject to psychological factors, et cetera, mood, attention, how well slept they are. All kinds of things will affect people's perception of pain. And so there's a lot of variability and therefore noise in the system. And so you need a much bigger signal to be able to separate it out statistically. But like death is a pretty objective outcome. And even a tiny difference in the number of people who die with a treatment, A or B, it can be significant, So those are sort of at two ends of the spectrum. And a lot of things are somewhere in between. So that's the gold standard of an efficacy trial. But there's lots of other kinds of research that we do that is supportive. There are pragmatic trials that look at how treatments or interventions get implemented in the real world. Do people actually take the drug when we prescribe it to them? We do what's called an intention to treat analysis, not what happens when they take the drug, but what happens when I prescribe the drug for them. That's a slightly different question. There's also like ecological studies and epidemiological studies. We're just looking at like what kind of people have this problem or should be getting this treatment, et cetera. And so you like to bring all of that to bear. And then, of course, there's the basic science where we try to understand what's going on. We want to know, like, how does this disease work? What's we call pathophysiology, and how does that relate to the mechanism of what we're doing? The body's fabulously complicated. It's this, if you imagine this system of this homeostatic system with, connections all over the place. And whenever you pull on one thread, you're affecting all kinds of things in the system. And it's also, it's a bottom-up evolved system. I think anybody who takes an honest look at how the body works can tell you that, meaning that it's messy. It's not an engineered system. It's a messy evolved system. And that's why everything has side effects, because cells that are using a receptor for one thing, there's another cell population using a similar receptor for something totally different, and it's hard to activate one without the other because they evolved from each other, you know. So there's also just inherent limits in our ability to affect the system, because the system itself is so complicated and messy. That's clinical evidence in a nutshell, but there's a lot of nuances there as well, as I'm sure as you can imagine.
Well, it is tough for the common person who hasn't got a lot of training in research design, maybe doesn't have much background in science, to really make sense. So it's a good thing to advise to go to these original sources, but sometimes they're mind-boggling for people that don't have the background to actually understand them. So other people will go towards looking maybe at consensus among, you know, medical practitioners or climate scientists or immunologists, whatever the issue is. But that in itself can be troublesome sometimes,
yeah.
To actually find somewhere that will give you a reasonable or an accurate idea of what consensus is in some field. Can you talk a little bit about searching for sources in various issues that we can glean some sort of consensus of the people that are working in the field?
Yeah, so it's interesting to note that, remember, I'm a physician. I'm also a science enthusiast, so I try to keep abreast of interesting science. But outside of my area of expertise, I'm just as lost as anybody else. You know, if I'm reading, if I get to like the primary, literature for a quantum mechanics paper, that's gobbledygook to me. I mean, that the jargon and the concepts and the math are just beyond me. I don't have the training to understand it. So while I like to get to the primary sources to see what they actually say, oftentimes they're just too technical. And then I really need help to understand what it's saying. So then what do you do? So there are, fortunately, there are robust systems within the scientific, communities for evaluating and generating consensus. It's kind of already built into this system. So it's actually not hard to find if you know where to look. There are lots of scientific organizations. There's a scientific organization dedicated to every subspecialty you could imagine. And they like to put together committees and panels of experts and review the literature and come up with consensus statements about what we think about X or Y. And so they're there. Again, you may need to know where to find them. You might need to find the website of the American Society for Diseases of the Big Toe or whatever the narrow area of specialty is, and they'll have the consensus paper on whatever. It's more than you could possibly ever, digest. It's all out there. So you have to have a basic skill on, well, how do I evaluate a review like that? So, what's the organization? Is it a science organization or is it an advocacy organization? Who was on the panel? Was it balanced? Was it objective? And what are they really saying? Are they saying that this is, slightly more likely to be true than not? Or are they saying, yeah, this is rock solid consensus. This is like, we could take this to the bank. We know that this is absolutely true. So you have to be able to at least have some way of reading how scientists communicate certainty and things like that. By the time this all trickles down to like the popular press or media, it's pretty distorted and oversimplified. So it is hard to, unfortunately, it's hard to rely upon that. One thing I do advocate is if you could find a scientist who likes to communicate to the public, and a lot of times, like me with medicine, I have found physicists and astronomers and biologists and whatever, people in different specialties who are good communicators and understand a lot of these issues very well, and they digest all the complex topics within their field for the public. And that's also often a great source of checking your understanding against the experts or learning new things. But of course, it's only as good as the sources that you're using. So then it becomes really important to be able to assess that. So you're never out of the woods. You're never off the hook, rather, for making your own evaluations of how reliable the information is. But if you find good sources of information, and they are out there for everything, you can find out what the consensus is. There is some way to digest that information.
So the idea is to start practicing this so that we get even better and better at actually doing it more efficiently. And we've talked about this before on the show, because trying to translate some of what we've talked about on this show to a person's real life activities, if we're really trying to check every issue that's out there that seems important, that's all we'd be doing. It would be very difficult to do. So the idea, the advice I've given, I'd like to get your opinion on that, is to prioritize. Take those things that we know are important in our life somehow, important in terms of maybe how we're going to vote or make a decision or who we're going to support, who we're going to get out and march for, etc., and to take those issues and treat those as thoroughly as we can with the research.
Yeah, I agree. You can't do everything. You know, you can't. I'd love to just spend all day studying cool science, but we got to put food on the table, and you just get exhausted doing it sometimes as well. But there are clearly some issues are more important than others. I think they're all good learning experiences. So definitely, if you're interested in something, even if it's not important for the world, do it, because you will learn a lot going through the process. Even if, no matter how irrelevant or silly it is, if you're doing a thorough analysis of how we know what we know and what the consensus is, you'll learn a lot about the nature of science and knowledge itself. And then you can apply that to issues that are important for you for some reason. Like, if you're a parent and you have to decide whether to vaccinate your kids, it is worth spending the time to understand what the science says about vaccines. If you vote and you care about the planet, you might want to spend some time understanding what the scientific consensus is about climate change and how we know what we know. But this is where the pseudoscience expertise comes in as well, because these issues have dedicated groups who are promoting misinformation. And so if I know people, obviously, there are people who are honest and interested and just trying to find out what's going on, and they get sucked down a rabbit hole of anti-vaccine conspiracy theories or, global warming denial. And that could be very compelling, because you have literally people who are experts in deception or who just dedicate a lot of time building a case for an ideological belief, and it's hard to be able to counteract that or to see through that unless you have a lot of critical thinking chops. It takes a lot of experience to be able to say, why the studies the anti-vax community are promoting, or the GMO, anti-GMO community, or whatever, why is that not reliable? It's all being distorted. So it's not even a level playing field anymore. You're fighting uphill against this avalanche of misinformation.
Yeah, I'm just going to echo also what you and Bob both said about, sharing that information, following your passion. Something I kind of learned in the computer industry is that sometimes you can get excited about something, and you do a big research project and you learn all about it. And the value of then curating that information to not necessarily like-minded people, but people who have interest. Because, once you do all that work, and it can be exhausting, even when you enjoy it, and even when you understand some of it, curating that information for others is, part of this kind of larger dialogue. So I really want to encourage folks to do that. In continuing the conversation kind of about science, evidence-based approaches, other than medicine, what fields of practice might benefit from evidence, science-based approaches?
Everyone. So I certainly anything that requires any investigation, any investigative specialty, really, really needs to understand critical thinking, the nature of deception, the pitfalls that we frequently fall into when trying to evaluate information. So, of course, detectives, lawyers, anything like that, even engineers, scientists, of course. The investigation itself is sort of an area that you can't really be good at it unless you, I think, are a critical thinker. But then again, pretty much any other area you care to mention, there's always some dimension of critical thinking and evidence that's involved. Certainly, we would love to have a government policy that is evidence-based. But, you know, I think getting back to the Neil deGrasse Tyson thing, there's nothing wrong with wanting to have, you know, science and evidence be valued and to be like the sort of the number one consideration when evaluating and crafting policy. I think where the criticism was that that's not all you need, though, because there's a lot of value judgments and, you know, that go into policy as well. And, you know, science can inform us about how to achieve a goal, but they can't really tell us what that goal should be or how we balance that goal against other people who may have different goals and different sets of values. So there's lots of other layers there other than just science and evidence.
Political and social layers, value yeah. systems, ideologies. Well, what kind of sense can you make out of that? How can we make that work? How can we mesh those different approaches?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that this is where more philosophy comes into play. And also, again, that there are layers of critical thinking at play here. So if you understand how, like what psychologists would call the default mode of human functioning, this is how most people function most of the time. We tend to engage in what we call motivated reasoning, right? Whenever we care about something, if we don't care, yeah, we'll listen to the evidence if it's not that important to us emotionally. But on any issue that we care about, which is like all of politics, right, we engage in motivated reasoning, which means we pick a team, you know, we pick a side, we pick a conclusion, and then we marshal all of our mental power figuring out ways to defend that position. Not to figure out what the best position is, but to defend this turf that we have staked out. And we're really good at that. But that's, of course, that's not very productive, because then you have people who are in entrenched positions and don't listen to each other and they're talking past each other. And then, of course, if your position is flawed, which, you know, most positions are going to be flawed in some way, in order to defend it, almost by definition, you have to distort the facts or engage in logical fallacies. You have to deny the science. And then when people do that, they start to deny science in general because it just gets in their way. So, you know, we see that happening all the time. But when you understand all of this and you understand the need for an internally valid process and an externally valid process, right, one that also comports with actual evidence about how the world works, then you realize that, okay, we have to slow down, back up, take a deep breath, and look at this from, you know, an objective, logical perspective, and I have to be flexible about my ideology or my conclusion because it may not be true or it may not be sufficient, it may not be complete. And I have to consider, you know, be fair to other people's opinions and their approaches. You know what I mean? So you start to value the process mm-hmm. and this sort of internal and external validity. And it's just a very different approach, but it's not the one we go to naturally. The one we go to naturally is motivated reasoning. The more reasonable approach is a much more high energy state. You have to work to get there and to stay there. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of motivation to do that as far as I could see in politics. It seems like the motivation more is to pick your team and fight for it. You know, that seems to be what gets people riled up and, you know, gets people elected.
This seems to me to be the wave of the future. I mean, we could even talk about artificial intelligence here and whether we would need artificial intelligence or computers to actually do different weighting factors for these different aspects that we're being talking about. But that's a whole other show.
I, for one, welcome our robot overlords.
Sure.
I do want to remind people that we are talking to Dr. Stephen Novella, clinical neurologist and assistant professor at Yale University, and we would like to open the phone lines and offer listeners a chance to call in, ask questions on the topic that we've been talking about tonight, make brief comments or ask questions of Dr. Stephen Novella.
Give us a quick little question. We don't have a whole lot of time left here with Dr. Novella, but we love to hear from our audience. And that being said, there is a vigilance in practicing critical thinking. And it does take a little bit of effort. It is because, you know, like I said earlier, there are some people who are very good at curating information. They're very good at it, but they're curating bad information. And that's where our critical thinking benefits us in kind of seeing through, you know, charismatic people with bad information. Yeah. And sometimes I have bad information. I appreciate people working with me on that.
Sure. And I mean, the individual bits of information may or may not be bad. They may just be cherry-picked and biased. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're only looking at information that's pointing in one direction, even if the information is legitimate, you're getting a distorted view of the picture. But you'll think that you have a good opinion because, well, all the bits of information are solid and reliable. You're just, you know, not aware of the fact that it's being filtered for a specific purpose. Or maybe you are aware of the fact that it's being filtered. And that's where we get the echo chamber effect, right? So if all you're listening to are opinions and facts and perspectives that agree with one side, it could give you the illusion that you have a really solid, reliable opinion that's backed by evidence, but it isn't. It's a completely distorted view of reality. That's even more dangerous. Mm-hmm. Having crappy information is easier to deal with than having this completely biased, filtered information.
I'm pretty sure I'm right because everyone on Facebook agrees with me. So we're going to go to our first caller. We have someone calling in. Hello, you're on Thinking Clearly. Do you have a question for Dr. Novello?
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest specifically about the anti-GMO movement and motivational reasoning, how that plays in. For instance, you know, a lot of people would say Monsanto is evil, therefore GMO technology must be evil. You know, if you look at the past generation, I mean, just a generation ago, every year you'd have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people starved to death in places like Somalia, you know, other countries in Africa and the third world, et cetera. But with GMO, you do have the creation of drought-resistant crops that do have, you know, do have an effect, appear to have potentially saved millions of lives over the past couple of decades. How does motivational reasoning play into the anti-GMO movement and their insistence that GMO technology should be banned?
Thanks for your call, caller.
Thanks.
We'll kick that over to Dr. Novella. Do you have any thoughts?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think that the anti-GMO movement, which is supported largely by the organic lobby, demonstrably so, funded and supported by that, and as well as certain environmental groups like Greenpeace, who I think just got suckered into this because it fits their narrative, again, that they're pushing an appealing narrative. They have a good story. It has a villain. It has a good guy. You know, Monsanto is a really convenient villain for these people, and they just demonize them beyond reason. They also appeal to emotion. They appeal to our sense of disgust. Yeah, and if people don't want Frankenfood, you know, we don't want these hypodermic needles sticking into our tomatoes, right? We don't want fish tomatoes with, you know, fishy, scaly tasting tomatoes. That's all nonsense, of course. But that it's a great narrative. It really has a lot of emotional appeal. And then they backfill, again, these sort of curated, biased, specific bits of information taken out of context. And a lot of them are wrong. Then they just make shit up. And that just becomes part of this narrative that people pass on. So like Vandana Shiva completely made up this notion that Indian farmers were committing suicide because their GMO crops were failing. It's nonsense. It's completely made up. But that now is part of the narrative. And then they, you know, people make up this narrative that Monsanto sues farmers who accidentally have seed blown into their field. And it's never happened. They actually inadvertently proved it in the court of law that it never happened. They couldn't come up with a single case to back up their accusation that this was going on because it doesn't happen, because Monsanto has never done that. But you know, people who have an anti-GMO view and read that literature, they all think that these are true. So they're misinformed with a bunch of made-up facts that are not true. They're diverted from real issues by focusing on the false issues, right? They equate GMO with things that it does not equate with. And they sort of buy into this whole package, this whole narrative package, and it sells very well. But you've got to dig beneath the surface in order to see that it's all built on deception and lies and misinformation and just things that are not true.
Mm-hmm. I'll even go so far as to say, as a conversation I was having with someone recently, you can also be against Monsanto and for genetic engineering, just like sure. you can be against pharmaceutical companies. I mean, you know, in a very general, broad swath sort of way, you can say pharmaceutical corporations have problematic issues, but I'm not against all pharmaceuticals, you know.
Yeah.
Amoxicillin saved my life at least once. We don't have any calls? No? Well, the lines are open. This is your chance to get in a quick call. We have about 7 more minutes. So I'll go ahead and ask Dr. Novella, in this age of science denialism, we're seeing that right now, especially in our political environment, and the tendency for many folks to cherry pick evidence that confirms their own biases, because I know I like to be right. We've referred to confirmation bias a number of times on the show. What can be done to increase the trust in and accurate reporting of scientific findings, in your opinion?
So that's a tough one. So we want to increase the general public's view of scientific findings. So it's actually pretty high already still. I mean, it's the scientists generally rank among the highest in terms of professions of among the public, and they are trusted in general. But people tend to selectively deny the science when it conflicts with their ideological or their political opinion. So I think it's more explaining to people how to think about these issues. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, you talk about the motivated reasoning. I think it's important for people to understand that you have to, if you want to have a reliable opinion on anything, you really need to try to prove yourself wrong, right? You shouldn't be trying to prove your position correct. You should be trying to prove it wrong. And, only hold on to those ideas that you can't prove wrong as hard as you did, honestly, as you try. Even just introducing that kind of reflective process would be a dramatic game changer to most people who don't really think about their thinking process at all.
I think that's some great advice.
Yeah.
I'm just going to jump in here. We have 4 minutes left and we have 3 callers on the line. So,
as folks, usual,
they like to call in last minute. Thanks for calling in, folks. But as we take your calls, I'm going to ask you to keep it really short so we can get through as many as we can. We're going to take our first caller. Hello, caller. Do you have
welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi, thank you.
Do you have a quick question?
A real disagreement about the facts here, because glyphosate has been banned in the Netherlands, in Argentina, in Sri Lanka, in Malta, in several other countries as a carcinogen. And the whole concept of Monsanto's Roundup Ready GMO seeds is there, to be used with glyphosate.
Okay, let's give Dr. Novella a chance to talk about that.
So none of that is true. I mean, that's not an accurate portrayal of what's going on. Glyphosate is actually a very safe herbicide. It's safer than all of the herbicides that it replaced. It actually isn't a carcinogen. It's been tested in animals. It's been studied ecologically in humans. It's just not a carcinogen. There is just one or a couple of studies that said that farm workers who are exposed to very high doses of glyphosate may have had a higher incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So first of all, that's not for consumers, that's not for the public, just in farm workers who were exposed to high doses. And even that is highly uncertain, which is why it was labeled a probable carcinogen, just like caffeine, right? It's like the same category as 100 other things that are perfectly safe and we take for granted every day. And that was just, an organization who has a history of overcalling, the carcinogenicity of things. So glyphosate is actually a very safe herbicide, and it's actually reduced the overall toxicity to the environment because it has replaced more toxic herbicides. It's also better than just over-tilling the soil and releasing a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, and that's been demonstrated as well. And the final point is, that's one application of a GM technology that has nothing to do with GM technology itself. And if you don't like that application, you have to build a case against that application. That doesn't mean you should paint a broad brush against the technology that produced that one type of genetically modified crop.
Dr. Novella, thanks for that response. We're giving you a workout here towards the end of the show.
Yeah, no worries.
Let's take our next caller. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello. I'm also very skeptical, doctor, about your opinions related to glyphosate. And part of the problem is that the studies that you mention have been drastically modified by Monsanto, or if the doctor didn't agree with what Monsanto wanted them to say, their careers were ruined. And check out a movie, you know, as long as you're into research, check out a movie called Genetic Roulette. It's very informative, based on facts. You can research every single thing they claim in that movie, and you will find that there is evidence to back it up.
And thank you, caller.
It's not a good picture. Monsanto is not a benign corporation out to save the world by feeding us. They are out to control the world.
Thank you very much.
We're going to want to
get a response.
Yeah, we want to give Dr. Novella a minute.
That's an excellent example of an ideologically motivated, you know, outlet that is marshaling only evidence which supports their premise, you know, that Monsanto is evil. They're not giving you a complete picture. So it could seem compelling when that's all you're getting exposed to. There have been thousands of independent studies, and Monsanto does not have the power to ruin the career of an academic at a university because they produce a result that they don't like. That's just a conspiracy theory. That is not reality. Monsanto was just another company. Seriously, I'm not defending Monsanto specifically, and I know corporations have to look at their bottom line and they do squirrely things. I've written a lot about the pharmaceutical industry and all the shady things that they do. Absolutely. They need to be kept an eye on. They need to be regulated, tightly regulated, in my opinion. But they're just not the evil demon that the anti-GMO propaganda machine has made them out to be. It is not true. Don't believe it.
Thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to have you as a guest and hear that familiar voice, Dr. Stephen Novella, clinical neurologist, assistant professor at Yale University School of Medicine. Thank you very much.
It's been fun. Thanks.
Yeah, we really appreciate having you here for Thinking Clearly with myself and Bob Frelick.
Thank you.
Yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. 'Cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same. Choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People Powered Radio.